Enrichmentality.com. Should we have school uniforms? Today I want to talk about the school uniform, and of course one of the great advantages trumpeted about the school uniform is its capacity to make everyone equal. If all children have to wear the same uniform, the theory goes, discrimination based on socioeconomic background, as is signalled through, for instance, their brand of shoes or jacket, will disappear. But is this really the case? Can uniforms actually exacerbate discrimination? Even if we assume that the benefits are true at the level of the individual school, as long as different schools adopt different uniforms, discrimination across schools will still exist. Let's take the example of my hometown. At the time of my attendance, both of the public high schools in my town had rugby tops as their uniform. Wearing a blue rugby top as opposed to a green one still identified a student as belonging to one particular school, and by association, it identified that student as coming from the kind of home that was zoned in that school's area. Of course, in Australia, the slight differences between two public school zones in a relatively equal society pale in comparison to the differences between public and private schools. Private and religious schools are much better funded not only by parental contributions, but they also receive more government money than public schools do. Again, to take the example of my hometown, the non-government school students on their way home from school or at an inter-school event were always immediately distinguishable from their public school peers. Both of the public schools in my area rank significantly below average on the Index of Community Socioeconomic Advantage, and unsurprisingly, the local Catholic school ranks well above average. But these differences were made all the more visible through our school uniforms. As a student, I regularly participated in inter-school events. The sporting events weren't too bad. Sure, the teams wore their school colours, but our appearance was relatively equal. For netball, we all wore a shirt the colour of our school and a matching netball skirt, and so on. But when we were competing in academic pursuits, like debating or public speaking, the socioeconomic difference between our schools was literally showcased through our uniforms on stage. Students from my school would show up in our polo shirts and rugby tops, two items of clothing designed for the sporting field rather than the field of debate. Our trousers were denim jeans. I doubt that I could create a more working class look if I tried. And we would be competing against well-turned-out private school students in blazers and ties, formal slacks and shiny shoes. I always wondered to what extent our appearance might have affected the judges' perceptions of our performance. My teammates and I certainly tried to look our best. Our rugby tops were always freshly laundered. And this was perhaps a mistake when the school changed suppliers and the dye in our shirts ran. Everyone rushed the local secondhand stores to get some of last year's supply. We took at least as good care of our rugby tops, polo shirts and jeans as we would have a proper uniform. We ironed our blue collars, trying to get them to stand up straight. But of course, the results could never compare. We were, by school mandate, dressed in the kind of casual clothing that would never be accepted in a professional context were it not for the fact that it was our school uniform. Our opponents, even before opening their mouths, looked like polished professionals. It was not just that they had more money, better facilities, and far better teacher-student ratios than we did as public school students. It was the fact that their membership of professional society was already evidenced through how they were dressed. Perhaps the judges were those type of rare people who truly do not see class, even unconsciously. We certainly won our fair share of debates. Maybe we were the benefit of reverse classism. Perhaps our scrappy appearance endeared us to the judges. But regardless of the extent to which our appearance may or may not have affected the judges' and audiences' perceptions of our team, it certainly affected our perceptions of ourselves. I doubt that our private school opponents got on stage worrying that they didn't look as good as us, or that the buttons on their shoddily manufactured rugby tops would pop off, or that the bright stage lights would shine through their thinly woven polo shirts. Eventually, my teammates and I discovered some old blazers the school had held on to since my mother's day. This proves that a professional appearance and public schooling do not have to be mutually exclusive. We even tracked down a store still selling what used to be the school tie. And for the first time, we learned what it was like to dress up and appear on stage feeling somewhat equal, even if it was in a musty, moth-eaten old uniform. After completing my secondary schooling, I spent a year at high school in Japan. And after my experiences in Australia, I was really looking forward to having a proper shirt and blazer style uniform in Japan, which I knew had much more formal school uniforms. Imagine my surprise, however, when I was assigned to an all-girls private school with a sailor suit as its uniform. Despite my initial reservations given the often unwanted connotations of a sailor uniform in Japan, which has become associated with a schoolgirl fetish, I soon got used to wearing a uniform that was more strictly enforced than the one in my hometown. Not only did our skirts have to be not too short, they could not be too long either. Exactly the same as everyone else was the rule. Socks did not only have to be white, but they had to be a set number of centimetres long and were forbidden to slouch. Girls would even use a product called sock glue to ensure their socks stayed up. And rules went beyond mandating clothing, extending to your personal appearance as well. Students could not have coloured or permed hair. And in Japan, a largely, although not entirely, homogeneous country, uniform inspections included not just the measurement of our skirts and other attributes of our clothing, but comparison of students' hair to a piece of black cardboard. As an exchange student, I was exempt from this process, but any other student whose hair did not match the card was forced to have it dyed black, even if their hair was a naturally browner shade. A naturally wavy Japanese friend of mine was even made to perm her hair straight. Even with so many efforts to make everybody the same, though, I noticed wealth manifested in different ways. Although students had the same school bags, they were allowed to decorate them, and the decorations students put on their bags ranged in value. While textbooks were all the same, some girls had fancy pencils, more expensive electronic dictionaries, better calculators, nicer pencil cases, and so on. Wallets and cell phones were probably the biggest sites of comparison, though, and at some schools in Japan, reports suggest a few girls actually engage in what is called compensated dating, or enjo kosai, in order to obtain fancy purses and gadgets to keep up with their classmates. So why are uniforms important? And why is considering what they do to us and for us important? Number one, uniforms alone are insufficient to promote equality. First of all, while uniforms may help reduce the appearance of inequality at a particular school, they cannot stamp it out. As I experienced, even with the strictest uniform, kids are still going to talk about what they got for Christmas or their birthday, where they went in the holidays. They will make comparisons. They will still know who has the latest video games at home. They'll still see who's picked up by their parents in a fancy car, or who has the bigger house when they go there to play. This is not an argument in favour of abolishing uniforms, however. Rather, it's an argument in favour of emphasising equality through other means as well. Parents and teachers must ensure that kids learn money does not make you better or worse than anyone else. It needs to be explicitly taught, and we cannot rely on uniforms alone to do this. Further, schools and governments need to address the way in which uniforms can exacerbate discrimination and perceptions of inequality across schools. While there is an argument to be made in favour of making uniforms affordable and easy to care for, it is also the case that clothing is more affordable now than ever before. If public schools in my mother's day could have shirts and blouses, it should be even more possible now. Ultimately, I believe that all countries should do what the current world leader in educational outcomes, Finland, has done. Among other initiatives, Finland has abolished the socioeconomic segregation of students by getting rid of private schools. Anyone who's interested in the best school systems in the world should definitely watch Michael Moore's movie, Where to Invade Next. In Finland, it's actually illegal to set up a school and charge tuition. So, as Michael Moore explains, rich parents have to send their kids to the same schools that poor parents do. And as a result, the poor parents help fund improvements to the school, that everyone benefits from. And kids growing up make friends from different backgrounds. Number two, you are what you wear. Secondly, I believe that what we wear influences how we feel about ourselves and how we act. If you've ever had to wear specific clothing for work, you'll know what I mean. Consider how you feel when you get ready for work or to go out for a social event. As you get ready, you start to get into the mindset of the kinds of behaviours associated with those clothes. Putting on a shirt and a tie or a smart skirt and a blouse makes one feel professional. Putting on a comfy robe gets you into relaxation mode. Self-help guides like Fly Lady recognize the power of clothes to transform your mindset in their suggestions to get fully dressed each day in order to get things done. In much the same way, I would argue that putting on a blazer and tie every day prepares students mentally for academic study, while putting on a polo shirt or a rugby top does the opposite. By choosing items of clothing designed for sporting pursuits instead of those associated with academic and business conduct, it's almost as if the school is encouraging roughhousing and horseplay in the classroom. Number three, you become what you wear. It's not just how wearing a certain article of clothing all day makes students feel in the moment. It's what it says about their future possibilities. We all recognize the importance of role play, especially for young children. We recognize the importance of expanding kids' ambitions beyond the stereotypical gender roles of playing mummies and daddies to other forms of play, as doctors, business owners, pilots, scientists, and so on. Yet somehow it is acceptable in society to segregate children according to their parents' capacity to pay school fees or to purchase homes in desirably zoned areas. And then we stick students in uniforms that appear to symbolize their possibilities. We send the children of lawyers, bankers, managers, and other white-collar workers to school in white collars, and the rest to school in blue collars. It's hard to think of a more literal example of society reproducing class over generations. And consider also the immense advantage that knowing how to tie a tie, to shine your shoes, to choose a jacket and shirt combination of appropriate length will have for students when they go to an interview in future. A student who is tying a tie for the first time can't hope to compete in terms of feeling comfortable and personal presentation against a student who's been doing this since they were 4 or 5 years old. Finally, four, the judgment of others. It's important to consider how others perceive students when they are in their uniforms. In a recent trip back to my hometown, I had the question of how others must have perceived me in my uniform partially answered. Strolling through the recently developed railway yards one afternoon, I came across a group of youths wearing dark hooded jumpers. My stomach lurched. My heart immediately started to beat a little faster. I even changed how I was walking to give them a wider berth. As I drew closer, however, I noticed that the letters emblazoned on the back of their hoodies were not the initials of some gang roaming the railway yards. They were the initials of my own alma mater. Since I left high school 15 years ago, the uniform has changed, and not, I would argue, for the better. Rather than swapping out the sports-inspired blue-collar garments for shirts and blazers, the school had apparently decided to introduce hoodies as part of the uniform, an item of clothing so associated with thuggery that the word hoodie itself is often used as a synonym for young hooligans. And the hoodie is an item of clothing so associated with armed robbery in particular that in West Brisbane, police even launched a hoodie-free zone initiative. After an increase in armed robberies by people in hoodies, police actively encouraged shopkeepers to ask those wearing hoodies to remove them. They even handed out anti-hoodie stickers. Acting Superintendent Paul Scanlon said, "By encouraging customers to remove their hoodies, retailers can minimize the risk of becoming a target." My old school has gone from white-collared shirts with blazers to blue-collared rugby tops to no-collar hoodies. It has gone from the uniform of a professional white-collar worker to the uniform of a blue-collar labourer to the uniform of an unemployed thief. The slide in expectations of its students appears clear. Of course, this is not to say that everyone who wears a hoodie is a thug. In fact, somewhat paradoxically, hoodies are also associated with higher education. During my first year at uni, I had one with my university's letters on it. But it was understood that this was a sweatshirt for jogging in on a cold day, not something to wear when giving a class presentation or representing the institution. In a town a 6-hour drive from the nearest university, where only 9% of the population has attended uni, less than half the state average of 19% or the national average of 22%, I would argue that the unemployed thug stereotype is the more familiar one. Indeed, you are over 3 times more likely to be unemployed in my hometown than you are to be currently attending university. And online searches for planned upgrades and increased funding to my old school return more results relating to the expansion of the local prison. Hoodies are what my high school has chosen as its school uniform, a piece of clothing so associated with illegal activity that not only do Urban Dictionary definitions speculate that it is designed to hide drugs, but that the police in some areas enforce hoodie-free zones. And I'm ashamed to say, I judged those boys wearing their dark hoodies in the railway yard, boys who were doing nothing more than walking home from school, gathering some fallen fruit from a public tree along the way, and talking about what they had done that day in class.